On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a whole
Paul Ryan met with Donald Trump this week in an effort to unify the party, and RNC chair Reince Priebus says the meeting went great. And in the era of Trump, what's the future of Republican minority outreach, and what does Hillary Clinton owe to black women? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jamil Smith, senior national correspondent for MTV News. And our special guest is Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast and host of the WNYC series Political Party with Kelly Goff. Welcome, everybody. So, Kelly, I actually want to start with something you wrote last month about what Hillary Clinton owes to black voters, and especially black women voters who have very high turnout and who have been really core supporters of her in this campaign. What was your thesis in that argument?
Well, my thesis is that when it comes to Democrats surviving elections, particularly close ones, there's usually is a constant, and that constant is usually black female turnout. Going all the way back to the midterm elections during President Clinton's time in office, when when they were surprised during the Lewinsky impeachment scandal to see how well Democrats ended up doing in those midterms. And the reason they were surprised is because turnout among African-American voters exceeded expectations in a number of states. And black women always turn out in higher rates than African-American men. And so, you know, we all heard the term firewall being used for Hillary Clinton's African-American support. And that turned out to be the case, because as we all know, Bernie Sanders has mounted a more significant challenge than I think a lot of people anticipated. So Hillary Clinton, like a lot of Democrats, is where she is thanks to the strength of African-American women. And yet, as I pointed out in the piece, we have never had an African-American woman elected to the U.S. Senate. We've never had an African-American woman elected to a governor's seat. And yet, why is it that African-American women are the backbone of the Democratic Party, and yet that same support doesn't seem to be reciprocated when African-American women like Adonna Edwards, who recently lost her primary for the Senate in Maryland, run for office? And so really the point I was trying to make is to say that at a certain point, African-American women should stop just being the support that elects other people, but should start being elected themselves to halls of power. And that's what I want to see more of. And people like Hillary Clinton can help with that by devoting the resources that they have at their disposal instead of to helping to elect the next Chelsea Clinton or, you know, George P. Bush even to office, but to actually elect some of the women who don't have those same networks.
I thought one interesting aspect of this piece was how this relates to dynastic politics, that basically when we have a lot of people we elect because they are related to somebody else that we elected previously, that privileges people whose relatives were in office 40 years ago or whatever it was, and at times when demographics in office were much whiter and much more male. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems like there's a long list of reasons to worry about dynastic politics. Is this a big one that should go on that list?
Well, what's interesting about you bringing it up is one of the reasons I wrote the piece is because New York Magazine had done a piece about how there's so much criticism of dynastic politics, but it actually benefits women, which it does. It benefits white women, right? So the piece was exploring how if you look at all of the increases in the number of women elected to Congress and elected to local and statewide offices, it's usually because of dynastic politics. So dynastic politics isn't all bad, unless, of course, you're not a white woman, right? And so that, to me, is one of the things I wanted to really talk about in the piece, is not just that dynastic politics is problematic, but it leaves out a lot of people, right? And so there are a lot of reasons we should be concerned. And so the point I wanted to make in the piece is we know that dynastic politics is still alive and well, but we also know that someone like a Hillary Clinton has immense advantages at her disposal, from her Rolodex to the people that she can get on the phone. And it troubles me greatly that we're already having conversations about her using those advantages to help elect a Chelsea Clinton down the road. And my argument is, why aren't we demanding that people like her use those advantages to help the next Carol Moseley Braun, who was not born to a family where there's a president and a potential future president as a mother. Those are the people who really need the advantages, or else we're going to see Bush Clinton for another 50 years. Bush versus Clinton for another 50 years.
What do you guys make of this? Because I feel like people object in principle to dynastic politics, but then when they have their own dynasty candidates they like, that doesn't stop them. I mean, we're in this epidemic of Justin Trudeau mania right now, where people are talking about how much they adore the Canadian heartthrob prime minister, who, of course, is the son of a previous prime minister, doesn't seem to bother people on the American left who like him a lot.
So, yeah, I think that Kelly makes an important point here. I think that what you have is a party-wide problem that doesn't just apply to black women, also black men. You saw in Maryland, you had the case of Will Jawando, who was pretty much the ideal candidate for Democrats going forward, had pretty much an identical biography to Obama, family man, came up through civil rights and political connections, really earned his place on the Hill, and really just had no chance in what ended up being the most expensive House race in the country. So, I mean, the fact that, you know, there have been no black women in the Senate except for Carol Moseley Braun is particularly notable. But I think that the broader point that Kelly is touching upon here is that the Democrats have to stop looking to usual sources. It's the same problem that really exists, frankly, within the news business. You see people only going to, apply resources and energy towards people whom they know, people whom they feel familiar with. And so I think it's more of a societal issue that we really need to confront. And the Democrats need to specifically listen to advice like Kelly's.
Dynasties are unfortunately part of human nature. I mean, there have been families that have over time had an elevated role in public affairs going back millennia. And when it comes to the specific question of black women, I think to have leverage, this goes to an art of the deal Trump point, you have to be able to be willing to walk away or go someplace else. And that's very, very difficult, given that a lot of blacks find the Republican Party completely unacceptable. Or two, you need to go out and beat people. And this was the key to the Tea Party's leverage for a period of time in the Republican Party. They went out and primaried people and defeated them, even if it was going to mean losing in the general election. And when you do that, people are going to pay attention to you.
And that, for that example, you again have the, you know, example of racial privilege. I mean, you have families, you know, Tea Party. Yes, they may be quote unquote Tea Party. They may be inherently insurgent campaigns, but they do have access to capital, you know, that frankly, these black candidates do not have. Not just capital in terms of money, but also capital in terms of connections.
Can I say something too, Josh, that I think is a big part of it? And to the point that Jamil brought up about the news business, is the thing that we don't like to talk about is how a lot of these really competitive professions, you have to start from a place with a cushion. And so when you talk about the wealth gap, like, yes, institutional racism is a part of it. But another part of it is that a lot of African-Americans who have, quote, made it on paper are often feel the responsibility to carry their family members who haven't made it. So why do I bring that up? That makes it a lot harder for someone who is African-American and has the right credentials to take a gamble like spending a lot of their savings to run for office, right? Who's going to do that when you know that your niece might not be able to go to college if you spend money that way? The same goes for, you know, taking an internship at a news company if you have the right degree, you're black and you have the right degree from the right school. So one of the things I'd like to start seeing in some of these institutions and halls of power is that the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee both spend hundreds of millions of dollars attacking each other. They could spend some of that money, even a fraction of it, to start a pipeline program where they nurture people for years that they think have potential and help groom them and provide the cushion for them to eventually run for office or to even run campaigns.
You're so right about the financial risk. One thing that struck me about the Ted Cruz Goldman Sachs loan story that Donald Trump beat him up over, they took out $1 million loan on this incredible gamble that he would beat a sitting lieutenant governor. And even the two people of their earning power, that's an enormous risk. You know, one's working at Goldman Sachs, the other's a high-powered lawyer. How do you do that if you're not of those
means? That's right.
Yeah. Well, so it's I want to actually ask Rich about what Kelly said there about sort of developing pipelines, because my sense is that the Republican Party at least thinks that it's put a lot of resources into this, and furthermore that a key Republican strategy about how do we get more of the minority vote is trying to put up minority candidates. I think maybe they haven't done enough of it, but I also think it hasn't worked as well as they think that it might, because the real problem with the Republican Party for getting votes from blacks and Hispanics is not so much about the race of the candidates, but about the positioning of the party.
Yeah, there has been major effort put into this. There are groups that exist to do this. And every time there is a plausible African-American Republican, this person is groomed to the maximum extent and celebrated in the Republican Party when he or she has any success. Tim Scott, you know, the senator from South Carolina, would be a good example. But unfortunately, there's just a lot of historical and ideological baggage that sadly makes it very difficult for Republicans to appeal to average African-American voters.
And I'm actually going to jump in here and defend defend the GOP on this for once, because I will say that when I was working on my first book, Party Crashing, and I did polling with Suffolk University back in 2007, and one of the things we found that was a bit of a surprise is that over a third of African-American voters ages 18 to 24 identified as independents. And there were a variety of reasons for that, but that actually represented a potential opportunity for growth for the GOP. Of course, then President Obama is elected to office. We all know what's gone on the last several years in terms of some of the rhetoric from the GOP. But even despite that, we saw that the RNC, for instance, staffed up with some really great people, Rafi Williams and Orlando Watson, and they worked really, really hard to build inroads. And I was actually very impressed with some of their efforts. Guess what? They're not there anymore. And their exits seem to kind of coincide with the rise of Donald Trump. Coincidence? I don't think so. I think that the GOP finds itself caught between this racial rock and a hard place, where you did have inroads being made. You saw the rise of Mia Love. You saw the rise of Jennifer Carroll, the black lieutenant governor in Florida. You saw the rise of Tim Scott. And you saw them actually making an effort to make these efforts. And they have been, some of them, surprised, I think, at how much this strain of racial resentment actually exists among their base, which makes it hard for them to continue making the case that they are actually all about diversifying, which means all of those African Americans who are identifying as independents 7 years ago, why should anyone expect them to then give the GOP a second look now?
I'm not sure why they're surprised. Frankly, they've been feeding that resentment. I mean, they feed it with the Southern strategy. They feed it with every other appeal to cultural resentment or, you know, even economic resentment, which we'll get into later. I think that also the black electorate is largely beyond representational accomplishments. I mean, think we're you know, we have a black president. We're not going to be impressed by the GOP electing a couple black senators or House members. What matters is the policy. What matters is the results on the ground.
Well, let us know what you think about the Republican Party and minority outreach at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, more on that and what Donald Trump means for all of that. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jamil Smith of MTV News. And Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast and WNYC is also with us. So picking up on something Jamil was saying before the break, there's been a lot of discussion over the last few weeks about, you know, what the source of Trumpism is. And there's a lot of discussion about the sort of, you know, as the roar of the white working class that has been left behind economically. And then also people saying, no, it's not about that. It's about racial resentment. And it's been interesting for me because I've been on the road for a couple of weeks. I'm taping in Chicago today, but in the last couple of weeks, I've been to places including Disneyland and Las Vegas. And on my travels, I've been seeing something in the wild that you don't see a lot in Manhattan or other, you know, sort of coastal central areas, which is people wearing Make America Great Again hats. And, you know, this is something I saw at Disneyland, which now costs $105 to go to for a day. I saw it at the Bellagio, one of the high-end hotels on the Las Vegas Strip. And it's a reflection of the fact that Donald Trump's coalition is quite economically diverse, including people with low incomes and people with high incomes. And so it's clearly not a coalition that's purely just about being the economically left behind. And I'm interested in, you know, what you guys see as the we look at all these possible reasons that Trump has caught on this year. Which are the important factors?
Well, I think a common thread throughout it is just anger and disaffection with politics as usual. So the and from that, a desire just to blow up the system as we know it and go with someone who is completely outrageous and different from every conventional politician. Now, Trump, in a lot of ways, actually isn't different from conventional politicians. He's a grotesque exaggeration of conventional politicians because he's a braggart. He's completely dishonest. He's willing to shift with the wind. So in all those ways, he's not really different than politicians. He just does it more and gets away with it in a way politicians typically can't. So there's no doubt that the bedrock of a support in the Republican primary was working class voters, and because of that, he was able to kind of cut a new electoral coalition we hadn't seen in Republican primaries before. But it's not just that, and I think anyone who underestimates his appeal in a general is making a big mistake.
Yeah, I like actually the fact that you pointed out that, you know, people are wearing hats in the Bellagio and other places that cost a lot of money to be, because, I mean, it really points out the fact that, you know, all this resentment about supposed, you know, economic displacement from, you know, by white working class voters who we assume are, you know, the large part of his base, it really ignores the fact that the black working class and the other, you know, working class of other people of color is not even up to where the white working class is. And we need to understand that, you know, white working class poverty is different than other kinds of poverty. And so while, you know, we're not going to ignore their concerns and we certainly take them seriously, the resentment is coming from a really privileged place. We have here, you know, the economic recovery has helped them far more than it's helped people of color. And so let's, you know, I think we should really kind of reserve any, you know, too much sympathy for their argument as they continue to justify their support for Trump by saying that, you know, this society is just getting too brown for their taste.
This might sound crazy to say, but I think if Donald Trump had dialed it back about 25% to 30%, hadn't had a couple key controversies that will dog him throughout the general election, I could see him winning 15% of the black vote, because if you have genuine working class appeal, there's no reason that can't cut across racial lines the way it does all sorts of geographic and religious lines. But just him alone saying he'll consider paying the legal bills of that goon who elbowed the young black man in the face, that alone is enough to sink him among black voters.
Well, but isn't the question there, though, whether whether Donald Trump's race problem is these sort of, you know, these explicit things about violence and, you know, the tweeting the photo of himself with the taco bowl and saying I love Hispanics and these sort of ham-fisted things? Or are all of those things a manifestation of an underlying worldview that has racial hostility that other exponents of that worldview might otherwise be more careful about not making those really explicit comments, but that would still be seen by blacks and by Hispanics and by other target groups as being, you know, dog whistles against them?
I'm not sure. I'm torn on how racist I think Donald Trump actually is versus how much I think he's really good at playing a racist on TV. And what I mean by that is, you know, I always, whenever I hear him speak, I'm kind of reminded of George Wallace, who some people know famously lost one of his first elections because he wasn't seen as tough enough on the blacks. And then when he came back and ran again, he said, I won't
you
be out.
You prettied up the phrase considerably.
Yes. And on that note, he said, I will not be out, insert N-word again. And he made sure he wasn't, right? He made African-Americans his whipping people, poor choice of words, but actually 100% accurate in terms of the political context of how he spoke about my people, right? And that helped ensure his political longevity. So part of me, in terms of watching Trump, I couldn't tell how much of it is really him and how much of it is performance art in the vein of George Wallace. Now, that's a long-winded way of saying that the larger answer is it doesn't really matter and I don't care because it's disgusting either way you slice it. But what I will say is that for me, the bigger picture about the impact his, you know, race dog whistling is having on the electorate is this. I, you know, I'm a registered independent. I've talked about that. I have voted, you know, have comfortably voted for both parties. I tilt one way probably more than the other. But what I will say is, as part of the generation I was talking about earlier, who fastest growing demographic of registered independents being younger African-Americans, the struggle people like me have always had with people like my parents who grew up in the segregated South and watched what happened when people switched parties and said, I would rather leave Democrats than be a Democrat who supports integration. People like me have tried to make the case. No, there are plenty of conservatives who aren't voting on racial issues. Look at my friend Rich Lowry. You know, those are the conversations I was having.
I'm all you got.
you're one of like three. No. And so, but those are the conversations people like me would have with my extended family and with my older relatives. And they would say, oh, that's interesting. And then, you know, my mother would say, oh, well, that Susana Martinez sounds interesting. Or Nikki Haley sounds like a good person. Donald Trump has basically detonated all those inroads that the GOP had the possibility of making. And to me, that is the larger tragedy because, because at the end of the day, if African-Americans are perceived as having nowhere else to go than besides the Democratic Party, then we will continue to get taken advantage of. We will continue to get taken for granted. You know, I've said this before, Josh, but my dream is to live through an election where I am treated like soccer moms or NASCAR dads and everyone does all of these ads targeted at me because I'm considered a swing voter instead of me basically being ignored after the primaries except for getting phone calls begging me to turn out. That should not be an ideal for any citizen, and that's how African-Americans are treated. And I think Donald Trump has made things worse because he's scared a lot of African-Americans into believing there are no other options yet again.
Well, two background points. One, Republicans are just going to have an inherent problem appealing to African-American voters based on the history. Because for African-Americans, the federal government is the greatest vehicle of liberation of all of human history. It literally liberated them from slavery, and then it smashed a hideous system of segregation. And Goldwaterite conservatism just looks at federal power differently for principled reasons, and that's just going to be a big chasm. And the Southern strategy, yes, there are dog whistles, and there is a very unfortunate element to it, but I think people tend to be simplistic about that, where you actually, if you look where Republicans made inroads in the South, it began with Eisenhower, and it began with kind of new South areas, the more suburban areas of the South, where there are people who were recent migrants to the South who are less likely to have the traditional racial attitudes. And it was the very last areas that the Republicans actually won in the South were kind of the deep South yellow dog Democrat areas that tended to be more racist than those suburban areas.
Right. But at the same time, the history of the Southern strategy has proven that the areas that they've truly locked down are those rural areas, those folks who turn out every election. And while those urban areas have gone considerably more liberal as time has gone along, it can't outweigh the considerable advantage that they've built over the last few decades.
But, Rich, isn't all of this stuff a reason to think that Goldwaterite conservatism is wrong in certain important ways? Like if it took the power of the federal government to smash Jim Crow, isn't it just a bad idea to say, well, we should really empower states and make sure the federal government doesn't encroach on them?
No, I mean, I think the federalist system is one of the great political science innovations of all time. It just happened to be that some people used it as a justification and excuse for defending an indefensible and unconstitutional system. So I think Goldwater was wrong about the Civil Rights Act, but I think it's wrong to take every position Republicans might have and say, you know, because working class whites agree with that, say busing, that must be a position motivated by racism or somehow wrong. You can oppose busing on the merits. You know, it only becomes a racist thing when you really think busing's a good idea and then cynically say it's a bad idea to try to appeal to certain racially motivated voters. And in a broader gauge, if you oppose federal power on principle, that's not a racist position, even if some ill-intentioned people might be attracted to it for the wrong reasons.
Just very quickly, though, something that Kelly said earlier, which is that it is a tragedy that, you know, Trump is detonating any progress the Republican Party, you know, genuine, you know, I know Orlando Watson and a couple other people have been working very hard to make the Republican agenda appealing to black voters. But at the same time, combine the history and combine Trump, and now you kind of have a party that is really going to decimate itself demographically, possibly well beyond this election. And I think that's actually a tragedy. I think we need two, at least two, competitive parties that are, you know, making, you know, appeals to black voters, saying, hey, we have these policies that should appeal to you ideologically, traditionally, and economically, however they appeal to you. So my hope is that the Republican Party can learn from this, probably take this L, you know, in this election, and then understand exactly what black voters are looking for and what in their agenda fits.
I actually did write a piece on the Daily Beast about how I actually think in the long term Trump will help the GOP on race relations, which I know sounds like an onion headline, but I didn't genuinely mean it. Because what I realized is I'd had a lot of conversations with friends of mine in the GOP who were convinced that, you know, what's that saying? Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you. They felt that a lot of minority voters were paranoid about the level of racism and intolerance in the GOP. And so I take the good news out of Trump is that they've been shown that that's not true. And I think that seeing someone like Mitt Romney seem genuinely stunned and apoplectic by how racist some of the language used against minorities has been is actually a good thing, because it'll force them to press the reset button after this election and start purging the party of some of the people who are responsible for some of this ideology and language. So I think that actually is a good thing in the long run.
Yeah, I also think that's been part of why this has been such a difficult couple of weeks for Paul Ryan. Ryan's mm-hmm. really a disciple of Jack Kemp, who really right. believed that, you know, a hopeful, opportunity-focused economic message could appeal to minorities. I'm not sure that was actually correct as a strategic matter, but I know Kemp believed it, and I know Ryan believes it, and I think he thinks that Donald Trump is ruining all of that.
Well, charter schools, for instance, or even something like charter schools, mm-hmm. which all the polling shows that there is ground to be gained among Republicans. And I'm not trying to be gossipy, but just to make a point, Paul Ryan's a different generation. He actually was in an interracial relationship right before he married. I'm sure he's appalled, right? It's genuine to see him appalled. If you look at, you know, John McCain's family now has someone of a different race in it. John Boehner's family now has someone of a different race in it. So there are people who see the world changing and they're okay with that. And I do believe they're genuinely horrified to see someone sending the message that that's not okay, that our world is changing. And so I do think that hopefully after this election that we'll see some soul searching and the Republicans will hopefully move in a direction that is more welcoming for minorities.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
I want to say a good word for Yuval Levin's new book, The Fractured Republic, which makes the case that both liberals and conservatives are beholden to a foolish nostalgia. Liberals tend to see everything through the prism of 1965. Conservatives tend to see everything through the prism of 1981. Neither of those eras are ever coming back, and it's time to get over it.
Jamil Smith.
I want to bring up the West Point case that we've seen in the media recently, which is of 16 black women in their uniforms about to graduate and posing what they call an old course photo. It caused a lot of controversy because they had their fists in the air. I feel like conversations about racial justice involving things like this get sidelined when we overreact and also call out political correction in one political correctness in one case and not in another.
Kelly Goff.
So we have one woman left standing, and that's Kamala Harris running for the U.S. Senate in California. Polls show her with a slight lead. But as I said earlier, that we haven't seen an African-American female governor. We haven't seen an African-American member of the Senate. We've had an Asian-American female, two Asian-Americans members of the U.S. women, members of the U.S. Senate. And Susana Martinez is a Latina governor. So I'd like to take this moment to encourage anyone who is a woman of color and who sees themselves as qualified to take the plunge and run for office. Or if you know someone who is a qualified woman, who is a minority, please encourage them to run for office. We need more of those voices at the table.
That's all we have time for today. Unfortunately, I have to forego my rant. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Jamil Smith, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Pajamas. I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
But we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of home. Let's call the whole thing off. Let's call.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes.
and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.